It's time for our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Results are in from last night's primaries in Arizona and Florida. The Democratic National Committee is making changes to its superdelegate system, and those in Washington and around the country are remembering the late Senator John McCain and what his passing means for politics.
And you can let us know what you think about McCain's legacy at 800-642-1234. Do you think politicians have something to learn from McCain's career? If you found yourself in disagreement with McCain's politics, were there any areas that you found common ground? If you're a Republican, did his reputation as a maverick bother you? And what do you think about his rocky relationship with President Trump? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, let's look at the primaries that happened last night. We just mentioned that they were in Florida and Arizona. Let's start with the governor's race in Florida in particular. That is shaping up to be a contest between two ends of the political spectrum. How did this race play out last night?
Definitely. You had on the Republican side Ron DeSantis win the nomination, and he is a lawmaker in the House who is backed by President Trump. He won President Trump's endorsement, and that helped propel him through the primary. And he's also a founding member of the very conservative House Freedom Caucus that's led by Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan. And so he's extremely close to the president and conservatives in the House. He will be matched up against Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who is backed by Bernie Sanders. And so you have a Trump-backed candidate on the Republican side and a Bernie Sanders-backed candidate on the Democratic side. Andrew Gillum is an African-American gentleman. He is a liberal, although he did support Hillary Clinton back in 2016, but a very interesting matchup, and at least if Gillum proves successful in November, he will make history as the first African-American governor of the state of Florida.
Now, both of these candidates in particular were kind of upsets to sort of established parties in the state. Andrew Gillum, as you just mentioned, beat Gwen Graham, who is a former congresswoman. She's more moderate. And Ron DeSantis beat Adam Putnam, who is also moderate and serves as Florida's commissioner of agriculture. These are two people that have been involved in Florida politics for a long time. What is that signal to the respective party leadership there?
I think in terms of Gillum, who was outspent, I think, 5-1, he was up against, as you mentioned, Gwen Graham, who's the daughter of Bob Graham, the former Florida governor and senator, really somebody who represented the establishment. Andrew Gillum, backed by Bernie Sanders, sort of captured the energy on the left, and we are seeing across the country in various races the Democratic Party shifting to the left, with people like Alexandria Cortez up in New York beating Joe Crowley in that primary. In terms of Ron DeSantis, I think our takeaway is that President Trump's endorsement does matter in many of these races. We're seeing it time and time again when President Trump does weigh in. Usually that candidate comes out on top. Not always, but for the most part, he is extremely popular in Florida. Obviously, he has his property down in Florida. It's a state that he won, and in at least among Florida Republicans, Donald Trump is extremely popular, and his endorsement went a long way in this GOP primary.
Now, there were also primaries for U.S. House seats in Florida's 27th and 26th congressional districts. They're both held by Republicans currently, but those districts voted pretty strongly Democratic in the 2016 presidential election. How could these kind of shake it up a little?
Well, in the case of people like Carlos Curbelo, who's one of the Republican congressmen down in the Miami area, who won his nomination yesterday, You know, he is somebody who is tacking to the middle. He is very pro-immigration, obviously, with the big immigrant communities down in Miami. He's somebody that frequently speaks out against President Trump on issues like global warming and immigration. And so this is sort of the question for candidates all across the country is, how much do you stand up to the president if you are a Republican in a vulnerable sort of situation and in a swing district like Carlos Curbelo is in? How much do you stand up to the president and push back? There's always a risk that if you push back too much, the president is then going to lash out at you or, you know, endorse a primary challenger or, you know, take resources and funds away from you. So there's always sort of this delicate balancing act for Republicans, you know, as they stand up to the president.
Now, I mean, we could spend probably the rest of our time talking about Florida, but let's also now look at Arizona, which also has been, you know, kind of at the top of everyone's conversations right now politically, because there was a race for Republican Senator Jeff Flake's seat that is up in November. We had Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who you might know as someone who was recently granted a pardon by President Trump, has been a big supporter of Trump. He was in the race. He didn't win. Martha McSally, who people are, it seems as though the GOP is sighing a little bit of a breath of relief there. She ultimately won with 52% of the vote. What kind of race did she run compared to, you know, Sheriff Arpaio?
Martha McSally is the candidate that establishment Republicans in Washington wanted because they believe she is the only person that can defeat Kyrsten Sinema, the Democratic nominee, in the general election as Arizona shifts more and more to the middle, as it becomes more diverse with the increasing Latino population, you know, as the Phoenix metropolitan area grows. And so she was seen as somebody who could take on Kyrsten Sinema. It is going to be one of the marquee races in the country. It will give Arizona its first female senator in history. We have a female on both sides, and so this will be a historic election. I think it's interesting, Arizona and Florida races were sort of determined on the same day. Both of the Florida governor's race and the Arizona Senate race will be two of the top races that people will be watching in November.
Now, it struck me as, you know, I was doing research for this, that the three GOP candidates that were running for Senator Flake's seat, you know, they didn't seem to align very much with now late Senator John McCain. They seem to embrace President Trump. Are we seeing kind of what you were talking about with Florida earlier, candidates who are looking more towards the president for approval here?
Definitely. All three of them, McSally, Sheriff Arpaio, and Kelly Ward, have relationships with the president. McSally has worked with the president on a number of issues, most specifically defense issues. Kelly Ward was an early endorser of the president and had been seeking a reciprocal endorsement from the president for months and months. Sheriff Arpaio, as you know, was also an early supporter of President Trump and received a pardon from the president. And so these are all three people who are sort of vying for the president's affection and endorsement. In the end, the president, advised by many people, held back and actually did not weigh in on who he preferred in that race. But establishment and campaign Republicans were telling the president, we really think McSally is the only person that can hold that seat for the Republican Party, which is extremely important because, you know, with McCain's passing, there's only a 50-49 majority that Republicans have. And so a single seat flipping could flip the entire control of the United States Senate. And so every seat will count in November. And right now, Republicans are defending both chambers of Congress.
So I want to move on to John McCain. He passed away this Saturday. He's being remembered by those in Washington and around the country. Let's take a listen to what his friend, Senator Lindsey Graham, said on the Senate floor yesterday.
If you want to help the country, be more like John McCain. I believe there's a little John McCain in all of us. And the little of John McCain, practiced by a lot of people, can make this a really great nation.
You know, we've been hearing a lot of commendation for Senator McCain. You know, really quickly, what do you think his legacy is going to be, I guess, as people keep talking about it moving forward?
Well, everyone in the Capitol knew the senator because he took time to talk to everybody in the Capitol, including myself and other reporters. He would, you know, answer every single question that you asked of him until you had no more questions to ask him. And that was very rare in the United States Capitol, where a number of some of the younger senators, you know, sort of flee from reporters now or just refer you to their communications director. So he was somebody who took the time, you know, and made you feel important and that your voice and your questions were important. I think in terms of legislative policy, he was, you know, it's sort of an end of an era because he was one of the old lions of the Senate who reached across the aisle and worked with Democrats, including Ted Kennedy, you know, and Russ Feingold on campaign finance reform. And so that sort of bipartisanship, that camaraderie, certainly, you know, doesn't exist as it used to exist decades ago. And I think with the passing of John McCain, a lot of people are wondering whether it's just sort of the Senate will descend into, you know, more partisan warfare. So, you know, of course, he has his military career, and that is unrivaled among lawmakers. And as we're seeing this week with all of the pomp and circumstance regarding his memorial services, both in Arizona today and in Washington, D.C. later this week, I mean, it's almost like, you know, the type of ceremonies that are reserved for a president of the United States. And I think, you know, because every single American knew who John McCain was, a lot of people revere him, you know, like he was the president of the United States. So it's been very touching to watch all of these images and hear all of these heartfelt condolences.
We are talking with Scott Wong right now. He's a senior reporter at The Hill. We're looking at the top political news of the week, and we are going to continue this conversation about John McCain in just a second.
And you can share your thoughts about John McCain's legacy at 800-642-1234. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, what did you admire about McCain, and what frustrated you? And do you think bipartisanship and respectful dialogue is still viable for politicians? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Now we are picking up our talk with Scott Wong, senior reporter at The Hill. We are going to be talking about John McCain for just a little bit. You can call in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to one of our callers now. We have Charlie in Milwaukee who wants to chime in on Senator McCain. Hi, Charlie.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My comment about John McCain as someone who had voted for him previously is that, you know, he seemed to be someone who was telling you the truth. And his disagreement with Donald Trump or Trumpism appears to be due to the fact that you have people on both sides, Donald Trump versus John McCain, who try to tell it the way it is, or at least appear to be telling it as it is, and not the way that the media wants to sugarcoat things. So I think that's where the new social media, the Twittering and everything else seems to favor Donald Trump and the hyperpartisanship that might not be the best thing for the country, but we do tend to go with someone that's going to fit the times and appear to tell us the truth. People are thirsting for people to tell them the truth.
Charlie, thank you so much for that call. And Scott, you know, Charlie is hitting on something pretty particular, which is people have been lauding Senator McCain as being kind of a lion in the Republican Party and just being a lion of a statesman anyway. And then we have this kind of new brand of politics with President Trump. How did they, I mean, we know of their disagreements, to put it mildly, but how did this interplay work with them?
Well, John McCain never supported Donald Trump, did not believe he was qualified to be president, and certainly made that known. In terms of policy, John McCain, as you remember, with the thumbs down vote on Obamacare repeal, essentially killed the Republican efforts and Donald Trump's efforts to repeal Obamacare. And that was sort of a dagger through the heart for the Republican Party when John McCain did that. But that was sort of his reputation as a maverick that was willing to buck his own leadership and buck his own president and do what he believed was right. I think that's sort of one of the big takeaways from McCain's life is he was a man of conviction. And, you know, with all of his faults and errors, and he was the first one to admit he made mistakes in his life and in his political career. But I think that's what a lot of people admired about him.
So, you know, as people are now remembering Senator McCain, and, you know, as we talked about those primaries a little bit earlier, that McCain was known for moments of bipartisanship, not all the time, but that he would work across the aisle. Is this going to be something that we're seeing more of a more rare occurrence given our current political climate?
Yeah, I definitely think so, because, you know, most Republicans now with Donald Trump in the White House are falling in line. You're seeing the ones, at least looking at the Senate, the senators who stood up to Donald Trump either have retired or have gone silent. There's very few now that you can look to in the Republican Party in the Senate who are willing to publicly criticize the president in an aggressive way. So with McCain gone, with Jeff Flake, his Arizona seatmate, retiring, you know, with Bob Corker from Tennessee, another Trump critic, retiring, there really are not that many voices in the Senate, you know, when you think of checks and balances, who are willing to stand up to Donald Trump and to call him out when they think he's wrong.
So let's quickly just shift pace just a little bit, because there was more news this weekend. The Democratic National Committee made a big change to the role of superdelegates in the primary election process. These are usually party officials or office holders that can vote however they choose for a presidential primary candidate. You know, what is changing there? What happened this weekend?
Well, the biggest change was that the Democratic National Committee, under the leadership of Chairman Tom Perez, voted to reduce the power and the clout of these superdelegates. These are people who are state party activists, who are members of Congress. Bill Clinton, former president, is a superdelegate. And so what they essentially did was they decided that these superdelegates could no longer support whomever they wanted on the convention floor for president. A lot of them bucked their own states and their own voters, and so voters maybe went for one candidate, and some of the superdelegates from those states decided on the floor or that they would support a different candidate, ignoring the wishes of their voters in their own states. And so you know, I think the bottom line is that this is really going to open up the process to make it more of an even playing field. You know, this is specifically a reaction to, I think, Bernie Sanders supporters who felt that party insiders very early on in that 2016 process had tipped the scales in favor of Hillary Clinton before many states had even voted. And so I think given the number of candidates we're expecting to see in the Democratic field for 2020, I think it's really going to open things up and make it a more even playing field. And it's going to be really a free-for-all with perhaps, you know, a dozen to two dozen candidates running for the presidency.
So this was a decision on behalf of the DNC, but I'm sure not everyone was on board. Who was opposed to this idea?
Well, I think some of the superdelegates themselves were opposed to it. Now, it was, you know, I think it was a voice vote, and so it wasn't a recorded vote, so we don't really know who specifically opposed it, but I think if you had that power, if you were one of the few who had those superdelegate powers and really could sway an election or choose somebody who you felt strongly about, even if your voters in your state were going in a different direction, I think those were the people who were most upset. But in the end, the party leaders decided this was best for the party, and as I mentioned, it was sort of a correction from 2016. And so they're moving forward, and they're hoping that the 2020 process will be better.
So I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here, but how much of this do you think was a practical consideration or a little bit more about optics? You did talk a little bit about voters who supported Sanders feeling as though a lot of the sway was going towards Clinton. Is this kind of a saving of face?
Well, I think it's trying to appease some of these Sanders supporters who really, I mean, this is sort of where the base of the party is now. This is where the energy is. I think this is also about turnout for the 2018 midterm elections, and so they're trying to energize the base, get people to turn out for the election. Not only in 2020, but in 2018, when you have the House and the Senate up for grabs. And so this is a move to say, look, we're listening to you. We've heard your concerns about how the process played out in 2016, and we're trying to make amends. And, you know, they're hoping that the liberal base and the liberal activists who backed Bernie Sanders decide to show up in November.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, anytime. Thank you.
Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans. He was catching us up on all of the top political news across the country.